Welcome to this week's edition of the Casual Shooters Podcast, your premier podcast for the casual shooter. This week's guest is a Southern gentleman, a Southern Greek gentleman to be more exact. He's been shooting in some form or other since 2000. I guess that makes him old, so we probably have a lot in common. He's been on the Training Group Live podcast several times, and he teaches at the PSTG Summit every year. So if you would, join me in welcoming to the show, Mr. Andreas Yankopoulos. How you doing, Andreas?
Yeah, good afternoon. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on. I appreciate it. If you would, go ahead and take a moment and introduce yourself.
Yeah, as you said, I've been shooting probably seriously since about 2000. Been doing shooting before that, a little more casually, and recently been doing more teaching, and yeah, so let's get going.
And people wonder where we get the Casual Shooter podcast name, because for 99% of us, we're all casual shooters.
Yeah. Then you at some point, you feel the call to step up.
Yep. All right. So I'm going to hit you with all the hard questions right up front.
Okay.
I've
listened to a couple of your shows, so I have an idea what's coming here.
Yeah, I've had a lot of people stutter and hem and haw, and so, all right, we're going to start right off the bat. Favorite movie?
Okay, I'm going to show my age here. I would say The Man Who Would Be King. Are you familiar with that?
I am not.
So I think it was around 1979, 1980. It's an adventure film with Sean Connery and Michael Caine, and it's based off of a Rudyard Kipling short story that they're ne'er-do-wells in British colonial India, and they decide that they want to become kings. So they head off into they just pack donkeys with some rifles, and they head off into this fictional land of Kafiristan and start training the locals in British warfare, and just hilarity ensues on that. But I'd say it's like a buddy cop adventure type film. Around that time, there were a bunch of films that I would say have a similar feel. Like if you've seen Zulu, or if you've seen The Last Valley, I think movies like that I really like. But there's action, there's character development, they make you think. But it's not the frantic pacing of some of the buddy cop action films that we have today.
Okay. I'm going to check that out.
So see what you think.
So is The Man Who Would Be King.
Yes.
And I mean, those are two very good actors. So
yeah. Yeah. It's, I don't know how many people have seen it. It's I think it's an underrated gem.
I'm going to be willing to bet that there might be 1% of the entire audience that's even heard of it.
As I said, showing my age.
I've got you by a few years, I think.
Yeah.
So, okay. I've learned that not many people read anymore. So if you read, what's your favorite book?
So I do read. I have kept that up. It's definitely not as much as when I was in my 20s and 30s, but I get a couple of books read every year. For favorite, that's tough. I've been thinking about how to answer this. I would say my favorite as far as that really stuck with me, I really liked Moby Dick. And more for the language and the storytelling. It's one I've reread a couple times. And it's just the way it's written, I just find is beautiful, just his use of language. And when I've read it, repeated readings, I just kind of skip over the sections where he goes into all the whale detail and just stick with the other chapters. And it's kind of like visiting an old friend at this point.
Yeah, it's classical literature. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Lord of the Rings I thought was fantastic. That's going to need a reread coming up when I have some more time. And as far as like books that really influenced me, if we're going to go in shooting, like some of Ben's earlier books, and we can talk about that later when we get to him. And yeah, those are a couple. I could keep going on books that I really enjoy.
All right. So I don't know if you're into superheroes. I'm not a big superhero fan.
Yeah,
but if you are, okay. So normally what I ask people is who's their favorite superhero, but if they're not into that, then who's your favorite historical figure?
Yeah, this is a tough one to answer. I would say, I thought about this a bunch, and I would say it's a type of person than a person in particular, but I can give some examples. That my day job is engineering, and I've just worked on a variety of projects for the Army and Air Force and some other branches, usually doing communication stuff, radio stuff. And early in my career, you get to a tough section. You're just like, I'm not sure what to do here. I don't know how this works. And then you talk to your management, and they make phone calls, and like you get put in touch with a dude who knows a dude, and this you end up talking to like an engineer with some gray hair, and he has just seen everything, he's done everything, he's been in your situation, he can tell you what probably makes sense to do. He can tell you 50 ways that he's seen it go wrong and just really put you on the direction. So I would say my historical figure would just be the people who work behind the scenes to just keep everything together, who have that institutional knowledge and that engineering problem solving approach. If you want to have an example on this, like maybe one of the guys at the top on this would be somebody like Kelly Johnson, who ran the Lockheed Skunk Works, just knew everything there was to know about airplanes at the time. And he would get handed some crazy task, and he wouldn't say this is impossible. He would just sit down and say, well, I've worked on these kind of airplanes, and like, I know that this jet engine exists, so we can try to dust it off, and like, that'll meet your power requirements. And then just, we got to deal with this heat issue or this altitude issue or this navigation issue. And he'd just be able to see, like, just from all of his experience, like, where do you go from here? And then start putting together a new airplane.
And next thing you know, you have the SR-71.
Yes. Yes. That's one of my favorite examples of that.
Probably the greatest airplane ever created.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah.
I was literally upset when they retired it, because I'm like, why are you retiring the greatest asset that we have, the untouchable asset? I mean, but I'm sure there's something that makes it no longer worthy. So
satellites got good enough. Or let's say multispectral satellites got good enough.
Favorite gun, favorite caliber. They don't have to be married together. So like, I know you've done some rifle stuff, which we'll talk about. So your favorite caliber could be a rifle caliber, and your favorite gun could be a pistol.
Probably favorite gun, I would say I have an Accuracy International AW in 308. And I don't shoot it much anymore, but just everything about that gun is amazing. It's
best gun. The Accuracy International rifles are the best guns on the market since they were created. And I'm having a brain fart. I wish now I had, I met the founder because I was at Quantico as an instructor.
Malcolm.
Yes. Why can't I think of his name? But he came to where I was at Quantico, and we had an opportunity to talk to him, shoot his guns.
I am jealous.
And I mean, we had the M40 A1s, we had an A2 and an A3.
It's not even the same bleed.
It's not. And I was like, oh, we got to switch guns. You know, I was a Marine, and I'm like, we got to get away from this M40 thing, because this Accuracy International is the bomb, and it is still the bomb.
I mean, that's how sniping in the U.S. worked, is they gussied up hunting rifles. And you look at the British approach was like, okay, we have a dude who's won a lot of like international competitions.
Seven-time world champion.
Yeah, I was like, what does he think a rifle should be? So he just designs it and starts selling it to the Brits. And it's, you look at it next to a 700, and it's like, dude, we're not even in the same league here.
We're not. And it's a factory gun. It's not like the 40 was a hand precision. Like, they took, it's a Frankenstein creation, because They took parts off of different guns and then they would create the 700. It was just, the only reason they call it a 700 is the action was a 700 short. And that's what we used, but everything else was piecemealed from somewhere else. So, you know, you had to have a very good armorer who took like a year and a half to learn his tradecraft full time to be able to build the thing to keep it running. And yet here is a gun off of a factory line, which would shoot a half a minute of angle, regardless of what you put down the barrel. Ridiculous.
And that's probably the buddy who talked me into buying it, shot one for work for a number of years, that he was involved in the development and like early use on target of the 338 Lapua. And I was talking to him, like I was getting interested in rifle shooting and putting together something. And he was like, he was telling me, he was talking me out of going anything custom. He's like, with an AW, if anything goes wrong with it, they can send you a new bolt, they can send you a new barrel, they can send you whatever. And it's going to drop in and it's going to work. And he just assured me, like, it doesn't matter if the bore is clean, if it's dirty, if it's hot, it's cold, it's going to shoot the same exact spot over and over. It just doesn't give a shit. And like, yeah, he was right.
Did you, have you shot their 338, the AI 338?
I have not. I've only shot mine.
So back in from 95 to 97, I had just gotten out and I was in the private sector training folks. Mm-hmm. So I trained law enforcement snipers. I was training civilians, all rifle stuff. And we had a loaner AI 338. I swear it was like shooting the softest 12 gauge 2 3/4 inch rounds out of a shotgun that you could shoot. I could have sat there and shot that 338 all day long. It literally didn't do anything to me. And this is a guy who I trained all the divisions on the M82A1A. They all came to me. Normally we do a mobile training team and we go out to the divisions and the Marines, but right after Desert Storm, when they adopted the Barrett 50, they decided that to make things easier, they would send all the division snipers, a representative from each of them to Quantico to be trained on this new system. And that's what I did. I trained them on that system. I'm trying to remember where I was going with this now, but
the 338 Lapua
AW. Right. So I've shot the Barrett. I was actually one of the guys who went to Aberdeen to get all the data to create the BDC cam for the inertial scope for the Barrett. So I've shot, you know, 50 cals. I've shot bolt action 50 cals. I've shot it all. And nothing shoots softer or better than that freaking 338 Lapua from Accuracy International. I was like, I'm just amazed at how good those rifles are and how easy they are to shoot.
Yeah, if you haven't shot one, it's like, no, you just don't get it. It's in a different league.
Really? It's like the Michael Jordan of rifles, literally.
The new ones, I think, are cool in how the barrel is more easily interchanged and it's more modular. I mean, the AW, I think, I like the look on it. I think it's a timeless design, like the Porsche 911. It's like that look is never going to go out of date. The new ones, they're cool, like for mounting accessories, for doing fancy stuff. But yeah, for the amount I shoot it these days, I'm sticking with what I have.
I'm with you. The only thing new that I like are the calibers. That's it.
Yeah, mine's in 308. And to your point, I got it because I was not reloading at the time, but I knew I would be in the future. So I wanted something that I could shoot with readily available or cheap ammo, and that's going to be a 308. I mean, the Creedmoor, the 6.5 Creedmoor, the 260 Remington were available at the time, and I got mine from Mile High Shooting, and they'd barrel it whatever you wanted. But the 308, what really impressed me the most was shooting 147 grain ball ammo out of that thing. That when I stretched the legs on the rifle, it would shoot well with that ammo to the point that it began to tumble a little past, it was like 750, 800 yards, the 100, 47 grain ball would start tumbling. And it's like, forget it. You're not hitting anything past then. But shooting that at like 300 yards, I mean, yeah, the match ammo worked better, but you're still shooting inch and change at like for 5-round groups at 100 yards with the military ball ammo, which was amazing.
Yeah, because that's not made for quality at all. I mean, that's just, let's see how much ammo we can pump out to throw through a machine gun.
And I was looking for decent ammo. So the Hurtenberger 147 surplus, like that stuff was solid.
So not Lake City stuff we're talking here.
The Hurtenberger, I got like the DAG, which is a German head stamp. Like that was decent. The British Radway Green, that wasn't as good as the other two, but it was still like solid training ammo. And then, yeah, I had some match ammo that when I would go on longer range shooting that I would bring along.
Well, we're definitely going to have to get into more of this rifle stuff when we get there, because that is my heart and soul right there. I'm very old school when it comes to certain things. As I look at 308 as the 9mm of the rifle cartridge.
So. Pretty much, yeah.
Your favorite caliber is?
I mean, for a rifle, 308, for pistol, 9mm, hands down. I like a 9, I just like it. It does what I need to do. I just know I can load a lot of it for not a huge amount of money.
All right. So the last question, I like to personalize it to the guest. And when I saw your Instagram handle a while back, I had to go look it up. I'm like,
most people,
what the hell does this mean? I've never heard of this. So, and that was the word flaneur. And I had to go back and look it up again. And I'm going to read this real quick. Okay. It's according to Wikipedia, it's a French term popularized in the 1800s and means stroller, lounger, saunterer, loafer, a man of leisure. So in your words, what is a flaneur and why do you aspire to be one?
I see this as something aspirational that, I mean, like right now I have to suffer the indignity of work to pay for things. And I hope to be over that sooner rather than later. And at that point, I have so many retirement projects that range all over the map in terms of, are they like gun stuff, language stuff, musical stuff? There are a lot of things that I want to just go explore. And I just feel like right now I'm kind of time constrained, and I'm sure I'm going to be time constrained when I don't have to do the day job anymore. And it's aspirational. I just want to be able to relax and just pursue these different interests, teach them if I get to a point, share what I learn, and so on.
I wish we had a flexible yearly calendar where when I'm not at work, the day is 36 hours long, so I can get more stuff done. But when I'm at work, I want it to be 18 hours. I think that's fair.
It's a matter of filling in around it.
Right. All right. That was very interesting. That is, you're the only guest so far I've had to actually go and look up a word, because I was like, I have no idea. I've never in my life heard of this, and I've been to France. Before we get into the shooting of firearms, mm-hmm. I've stalked you. I'm okay. A professional stalker.
All the interviewers are.
Yeah. If you're listening to the podcast, don't do that at home. You should leave that to the trained professionals. But you seem to enjoy taking a lot of pictures, so photography.
Yeah.
Is that a hobby of yours?
It's always been a hobby. It still is. There's not a lot of recent stuff on there for some technical reasons that I'm sorting through. I've been interested in photography since middle school when I learned to develop black and white film. And I did that for a while. That's something I kept up. Did some more in grad school. We had like a Georgia Tech had a photo club where you could get access to the dark room. So I did a bunch of black and white photography there. And when I got with digital photography, I started started on that, was doing a lot of like landscape and macro photography. I'd go out and look for like dragonflies, damselflies. I learned a lot about how those things tick, how to photograph them, like habits and such. Had some pretty neat pictures on that. And I had some friends who were starting a photography business doing weddings. And they're like, hey, you're taking really impressive pictures of dragonflies. You want to come shoot weddings with us? I'm like, yeah, sure. So I tagged along with them and just learned how that worked and ended up doing that as a side business for a couple of years. Like this was in the earlier days of digital SLR photography when they still cost a good amount of money and not everybody had one. And that the flash usage was still a little bit tricky. So I had a system with a Nikon D700, which I think that was their second full frame digital SLR. And then some F2.8 zooms on that. And yeah, just did a bunch of weddings. So usually it would be two of us. I would, like, we'd all handle it, things in the, like, early on. I would do the groom photos and the groomsmen, whoever was working with, to do the bride. And then we'd both shoot the ceremony and work together doing the group photos afterwards, and then the reception and dinner and dancing and stuff afterwards. So that was fun. It was like very high pressure, very things are only going to happen once. It's like you're there to document an event and they're not going to redo stuff for you. So there are a couple pretty high pucker factor things that were going to happen. Like the bride and groom would tell us like, hey, this is going to happen and we need pictures of it.
You don't do anything half-assed, do you?
No, not usually.
Yeah. Everything I've looked at, everything I've seen and hearing you talk, you don't do anything half-assed. Yes. Okay. I like that. I can appreciate that.
Yeah. Usually whatever I'm working on, I want to be at least decent on. I'm never going to be great at it, but like I can get the decent.
Did you grow, you said your dad was in the military.
Yeah, he was in the U.S. Army and retired, well, got out of the military when I was still, I think I was two, something like that.
Okay.
And he, we didn't have center fire or rim fire stuff around the house, but we always lived in a suburban area where you could shoot air rifles or air pistols in the backyard. So I did a bunch of that. Like I saved up, I got a spring piston air rifle when I was in, I think, 9th or 10th grade. And that thing would shoot out to 50 yards, no problem. And so I learned a bunch of basic rifle stuff with that. And he knew enough, like he remembered enough from the military to show me some basics on that. But it wasn't, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, what got you interested enough to buy your own air rifle?
I mean, I had like a little, like I think a Crossman 760, which is one of those pump ones.
And okay.
It was like, it pattered, like it wasn't very accurate at all. And like, this was way before the internet, and you would go like my parents would, we'd go to the mall and we'd meet up at the bookstore or something like that. And I would just browse the magazine aisles and you'd see like an air gun magazine. And you start flipping through and you're like, wait a second, like I never knew that this existed. So they had pictures, like they had all the like Olympic air rifles and different sporter rifles, and there'd be like matches. Like this is, a lot of this stuff was coming out of the UK and Europe, because they're not allowed to own real guns there for the most part, or it's really difficult, but you can buy air rifles.
Right.
So they have all sorts of organized competitions and like they're really pushing the limits on what you can do with air rifles. And yeah, when I started flipping through magazines and seeing these things and you start looking at the price tags, you're like, nope, 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 nope. And you're like, okay, I'm slinging popcorn and drinks at a movie theater, but I can make this one happen. So
yeah. Have you seen any of the new stuff now? Like they have 50 cal air rifles that they'll hunt game with.
Yeah. Oh, people don't realize Lewis and Clark had air rifles. when they're on their
what?
Yes, you should look this up.
Are you kidding me?
No, no. Like, because they realize, like, well, we're probably not going to be able to keep powder dry, so they brought air rifles.
Well, I am going to have to look that. Yeah. You're making me look up a lot of stuff, Andreas. You're very.
Yeah, there is, like, people give air rifles a short drift. Like, there's a lot going on there.
Especially yes.
Now, like, I've looked into it. It's not worthwhile. I just don't have time for it. Like, the, because we live in city of Atlanta, so I can't shoot in my backyard, but air rifles I could do. And, I mean, looking at the different pre-charged pneumatics where you have a, but you're like, you're either committing yourself to cycling out CO2 tanks, or you're buying like a compression system, because these things run very high pressure. And you need special pumps that are removing, that have dehumidifiers built into them to remove wow. humidity from the air as you compress it. Yeah, it's, but yeah, the accuracy that these things can do is ridiculous. And just,
yeah,
if you want to go on the power end, yeah, as you said, they're 50 cal ones that'll shoot 100, 200 yards, no problem.
Yeah, my son, he's first started hunting rabbit and squirrel with an air rifle. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they're very good.
Yeah, you can do that very humanely. And that's like, yep. not even the high power ones.
Nope, not at all. So at what point then did you go from shooting air rifles in your backyard, that type of stuff, to... You said on your website in 2000, you started shooting IDPA. So what bridged that gap for me? How does that happen?
So, well, I turned 21, so I could legally buy firearms. And I did my undergrad at Carnegie Mellon, and there was a gun club. So I met people who lived off campus and had various firearms and went on some range trips. And looking in retrospect, like, nobody had any idea what they were doing. I mean, beyond basic safety. But there were, I had a friend who had a Dillon 550 and was reloading on that. And then again, this is like, the internet is like starting to happen at this point, but it's mostly text-based. So there are news groups and discussion forums on firearms, but really not much in the way of pictures yet. But then you had all the different magazines like American Handgunner and whatnot. And they would have pictures of IPSC matches, USPSA matches, once that happened. And so you could at least see what, like, in principle was going on. And so the first IDPA match I went to was that, it was a Springfield clone of a Colt Commander. And a friend of mine, I had a holster for it and some mag pouches, and I would just go outdoors and shoot. There were just some places around Atlanta you could just go into, like, dirt areas that were undeveloped, and people shot there. You could tell because there were cases on the ground. And a friend just had started shooting some IDPA matches and drugged me to that. He's like, "You want to go do this?" I'm like, "Yeah, it sounds fun." And it was the usual thing. It's absolute disaster. Remember, there was a... popper out. There was like a mini popper at 25 yards, and I went to slide lock twice. And I was like, and you've already picked it up. It's like, I don't like doing things. I don't like being bad at things. So I was like, okay, I'm going to figure this out.
And oh, that's hysterical.
Yeah.
And I love hearing people's first stories, because they're all, I mean, not all, but most of them, we all share a common theme of they're not the best. They don't go the best.
No, I mean, I had no idea what to expect. I was like, I've never done this before. I don't expect to be good at it. But also just seeing that there were people at the match who were like solid shooters, and being able to see that. And like, none of it really, it didn't scare me. I was like, yeah, I can do that. So it seemed attainable what the people at the match were doing.
Okay. Now you were a student at the time.
Yeah, I was in, at the time I was a grad student at Georgia Tech.
Okay, so you were a grad student. Yeah. Okay, so you lived off campus?
Yeah.
And at this point, did you already have an engineering degree, or was that what you were getting your...
Well, I had an undergraduate in electrical engineering, and then I was at Georgia Tech going after a PhD in that.
Oh, so do you have your PhD in engineering? Oh, looky there. Very educated. No wonder you're using words like flaneur. Now I get it. That's a different dictionary. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So we chatted a little bit earlier. So I think now might be a good time to kind of interject some of this. And yes. When you were at Georgia Tech, you said there was a caving course that was student run.
Yeah, so Georgia Tech has what's called outdoor recreation at Georgia Tech, or ORGIT, which is a student-run outdoor club. And it's one of the best in the country, in that there's an area set aside for the students, and you walk in and it's like walking into REI, that you have 30 whitewater kayaks, whitewater canoes, all sorts of climbing equipment, all sorts of backpacking equipment, all sorts of caving gear. I mean, thousands of feet.
Wow.
Headlamps, backpacks. I mean, anything you would need, or virtually anything you would need. Like, you got to bring your own clothes, but beyond that. And the whole thing is student run. And it's set up that you can show up like I did. Like, I had been in a cave, like we had done that in college. And I was like, this seems cool. I want to do more of this. And they will take you from, I've never been in a cave before, and you will have student instructors. You get a safety briefing, then you go out to a cave, and it's all students. Like, students are driving the vans or the cars. Students run the whole thing. You check out gear in the morning. You come back after caving, check the gear back in. And they will take you from never having been in a cave before to like the basic class. You end up going and doing a 200-foot vertical drop. So where you're throwing a rope down a 200-foot pit and you're rappelling in and climbing back out and then doing some caving at the bottom. And that's like the basic curriculum, all student led. And then after that, you can just check out gear and go caving. And like, for the gear to check out ropes and such, you have to be an instructor. And there's a process for getting to that. And it's just like you make friends with the other instructors and you go along on trips and they just teach you how to do everything. And it gets to where, I mean, we did like taking 1500 foot ropes down to Mexico to go do some really big stuff.
Wow. And so you did go outside of Georgia when you did this?
So again, this is a little kind of luck that the area, Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia, where those states intersect, is called TAG. And it's one of the highest density areas of caves in the world. And there are people that come in from all over the country to go caving in that area. And we've run into international people at some of the caves. Like, there's one cave, there's Cave Ellison's in the Pigeon Mountain in Northwest Georgia, that has you got to do some caving before you get to it. But underground, there's this 586 foot deep pit, and that leads to a couple miles of passage at the bottom. And yeah, there are people coming from all over to do that.
Who in the world found that hole and realized there was caverns that you could walk at the bottom?
So you go look for caves. You just go ridge walking. Like, you kind of know. We had a guy I kind of met through caving, who is a USGS, like a geologist. Like, he could talk to you hours about rocks. And he would just explain that the way Georgia is built, you have these layers of limestone and sandstone, and you can predict where the cave entrances are going to form. And so you're getting a topo map, you're like walking topographic lines, and you're looking for entrances. And this was an area, like, this cave was found very deliberately, that people knew there was over 1,000 feet of depth potential at this area. So they just spent months, and then they found an opening and they just pried it open. Like, even today, it's like you got to take your backpack off to get into it. And then they just started pushing back in there. And then there's like a 150 foot pit near the entrance. And then they got to a really big pit, and then they dropped a rock in. And it took, I think, like 5 or 6 seconds before they heard it hit. And they're like, yeah, we got something good here.
Yeah. Wow. Those are tight.
Yeah. The stuff in Mexico is a lot of it's the exact opposite. Like, you may have seen video of people, base jumping into a big hole in the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've been there a couple of times where that's a third, it's about a, it's 1100 feet and change. And yeah, you just bring a really long rope and takes a bit to climb out.
I don't think I've ever been around an 1100 foot long rope.
Yeah, we bought a 1500 foot rope for that trip.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of rappelling and I've never, not that high.
But I brought this up because a lot of it I think gets to, I learned a lot about teaching and instructing physical things doing that. Like it's one thing to teach math or to teach things where you're like sitting there in a room, like in an air conditioned room, learning it. It's another thing to teach messy skills where you're like out and about and it's physical. And we just, yeah, there was a lot of discussion on like, how do you teach people to cave? How do you teach people to rock climb? And I think just a lot of these physical skills translate over to shooting.
So just having a lot of experience,
like I got up to where I was taking out beginner trips and caving and like also a lot of the safety precautions I think about, like there's like when you're about to hop on a rope and take a 200 foot plus ride, you want to make sure that your gear's on correctly, right?
For sure.
And like this happens, like people don't have their gear on correctly and then they die. And ooh. I kind of take that as similar to a make ready on a stage. Like you're not going to die if you screw up the stage, but it's going to be embarrassing and it's not going to be fun. So you just have the whole process of how do you make yourself, like you're about to step on this rope. How do you double check that you have everything? And I think about stages similarly. Like I'm about to shoot the stage. How do I make sure that, like what can I do to prepare for it? A lot of ritual, just the kind of the coming up with rituals to go to do this. I think there's a lot of carryover.
Right. So you've come up with your own system of like your pregame to make sure everything's good to go ready. Yeah.
And in caving, there's kind of a accepted way of what you do. And it can and people talk about it in shooting. And I'm sure there's, you have like regional variations on all this stuff, but yeah.
You've traveled a lot. Like it looks like you've been to Iceland more times than people who are actually from Iceland. You've gone other places in Europe and stuff. Have you ever gone on any trips just to do caving or things like that to do while you're out?
We've done a lot of trips to go hiking. We've done some caving on vacation, but it wasn't deliberately for that. Like it was more like when we were in Slovenia, there's a really amazing cave in the southern part of the country where you're boating inside the cave.
And wow.
Yeah, it's wild. So we did that. And it was like we just brought along, they had most of the equipment we needed. Like we just needed warm clothes and whatnot.
That's pretty cool. After you shot that IDPA match, you shot IDPA for a little bit, but then you stopped.
Yeah.
You said you kind of plateaued and that's where that ended, but then you picked up carbine and long range rifle.
Yeah. This is early days of the internet and I was shooting with some people who were good and like they were a little bit better than me and could teach me what they were doing, but like I made it up to an IDPA, I was CDP expert and I could get the master, I could shoot a master classifier with my 1911, but yeah, I just didn't like, I'd slightly miss it when I would shoot it at a, an actual classifier match. And like I said, I did some classes. In retrospect, those classes were very different than how a lot of teaching is done now and how I teach now. But I wasn't getting my improvements in the match results. And at that point I just thought, let's do something else for a while. And that's when I picked up a a carbine and did some, like I built an AR-15 and, assembled an AR-15. And I did some shooting of that. I had some friends in North Georgia that I would shoot with at a range. And there's a guy, Mike Benedict, that I used to shoot with a lot. That he was an OG IPSC guy. And he had been all over the world shooting, like both for matches and for other stuff. And he could run an AR-15 well. He could Mike Benedict's house was just you never knew who you were going to run into when you would go visit. Like there would be people visiting from all over just to hang out and shoot with him. He's just one of these people who knew everybody. And so I shot with him a bunch, learned some AR-15 stuff or carbine stuff. He had organized some classes with Dave Harrington, who taught some AR-15 classes. I picked up some more from him. And then I think when he got his company started and started selling uppers, like that caught my eye. I was like, yeah, this would be something fun to try, like a precision AR. So I put one of those things together and shot it. Like I found some local instructor who was able to help me out. And I only had access to about a 300 yard range. And then he took me out to a range that went to a little bit past 400. And then I got to shoot some suppressed firearms. I'm like, yeah, this sounds really cool. This is really cool. And realized that I wanted something that could shoot farther than I had a 16 inch 223 and, realized that I think putting a suppressor on a bolt gun would be more what I wanted. Just that you don't have it's a sealed breech. So it's a lot more pleasant, I think, to shoot with a suppressor than an AR-10. And that's where I ended up talking myself into the AW at that point. And then, that's how that ended up. And then, there are some places in Georgia. There's a place, they've had a couple of different names. I think it's called Arena Training in Blakely, Georgia. And they have that goes out to at least a mile, and they have an unknown distance range where they have steel out 1500 yards plus. So I did a couple trips down there, and that was certainly a lot of fun. And then I started looking into I can get around with a precision rifle. Let's look at matches. And that was pretty disconcerting as far as looking at, if you live in Atlanta, there's just not a lot around there. Like if you lived out in Las Vegas, I'd probably be shooting precision rifles to this day. Like you just take a 4x4, go onto BLM land and shoot. And you just can't do that in the Southeast.
You can't do that east of the Mississippi.
Yeah, that's really how it works.
Yeah.
It's like, you can't really, if you live west of this Mississippi and you have BLM land nearby, you can do that. And there are matches. You have a lot of people. There's a lot of local possibilities. And so it just got a little bit depressing. That took the wind out of my sails. And I'm looking at what it would take to move my skills to the next level. And it's like, I don't have time for this. I don't want it that badly. I'm not going to every weekend be gone. It's I was married at the time and had other stuff going on now. And
with your carbine, what did you compete in and what was the farthest target you had to engage in your competition?
I never shot any formal matches with it. I mean, I don't even know if there was anything around Atlanta. I looked a couple of times and there were IDPA matches, there were USPSA matches, and US Arms didn't exist. PCSL didn't exist.
PRS didn't exist.
I don't know on that.
Yeah, I don't think it did.
When I just started looking into it, that was also, you had the Soldier of Fortune matches that would go on, and there were these outlaw matches. And you're like, am I going to drive to Virginia to shoot a match? And that was the basic, that's your basic driving, is just going to another state or driving.
I don't think I think the, your average pistol shooter who shoots USPSA or IDPA or whatever, Steel Challenge, none of them really have understand the concept of just how expensive and difficult it is to shoot rifle matches because they are so much farther spread apart.
Yep.
It's typically always overnight travel.
Yep.
You know, it, there's a lot to it. Like I used to, right before I started shooting USPSA, I got back into NRA high power shooting. And that was a weekend trip every time I went to a match. I had to leave Friday. So I'd stay Friday night, Saturday night, come back on a Sunday, spend all day there each day. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's when I started pricing it out. Like I'm looking at going to, because they ran matches at Blakely. I forget what they're called. Again, I think it's Arena now. And I'm pricing out like, okay, if I want to shoot a match here, I got to leave the day before, drive, I need a place to stay. You're looking at how many miles you're putting on the car, how much gas is that? And yeah, I tell people with pistol shooting, it's like the price of your pistol is basically irrelevant once you get seriously involved in.
Right.
And it's like, I'm looking at what I put in the, like what I have in my AW. And it's like, yeah, that I would have eaten that up in match fees and travel in the first year shooting matches easily.
And AI is not a cheap gun.
No.
Mm-mm.
Even back when I bought them.
Right. Yeah. They've never been cheap.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of like, would you call a custom 2011 cheap? No, because it's a good quality gun.
Yeah.
So you're paying for quality. So
yeah. Yeah. So the same buddy who took me to the first IDPA match kind of rescued me at that point and took me to a Steel Challenge match. And I just feel like, yeah, I like this. I can drive 45 minutes and shoot Steel Challenge.
Right. And then just go home afterwards. Yeah.
Yes.
A lot less stuff to drag around.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So I shot those for a while. And
do you still shoot any of that?
I haven't in a long time. I was just thinking, like, what ended up happening is I shot Steel Challenge a bunch. And a lot of the people that shot Steel Challenge also shot USPSA. And that's like, I just like, okay. They're like, well, just come shoot USPSA with us next weekend. I'm like, yeah, it sounds fun. So I did that.
Can you think of a better match for just practicing calling your shots and transitions than Steel Challenge?
I tell people to start with Steel Challenge regularly. Like if you've never shot a match before, that's what you should go do. It's you have your five magazines, you put the five mags on the table and you're just drawing, shooting a simple course of fire. You're learning to shoot under pressure. You're learning to react to the timer. You're learning safe handling under the command of an RO. You can shoot rimfire if you want. That's like, yeah, that's what you should start.
I love Steel Challenge, but I kind of got burned out on where I would go to shoot. It would sometimes the squads would take forever to move between bays. And I just got tired of, I would literally get done with a stage and then wait 30 minutes to 40 minutes to wait to actually move on to the next bay because it would take them so long. So yeah. I just stopped going because of that. But man, it is the best stand and shoot drills you can do.
Yeah, the rule set is great. The way it's implemented at the local club, that's going to vary widely.
But I agree with you. Great place to start. So then 2 years after that, you got into USPSA.
Yes.
So were you bitten by the bug is the first time you shot it?
I thought it was fantastic. Yeah. I mean, the stages were really interesting. It was much more dynamic and higher round count than IDPA. And of course I shot the matches like IDPA to begin with. And I got body bagged, but,
I don't think I've heard that term. Yeah. I got body bagged. Yeah, I got murdered.
My ability to shoot and like do A's, like punch A's at a decent speed. Like that was good. But the whole moving around the stage was, I see video from back then. And it's just, whoa, who is that guy? It's, it's astounding. And, yeah. So that was, it was rough. It was rough. And it was even more rough because you, because of shooting Steel Challenge and getting reasonably good at that, I was able to class, like the first classifier, I got classified as A out of the box. And this was when all those classifiers were stand and shoot. And like, I go to a match and I get beaten by C-class dudes.
Right.
Like I had,
because you hadn't learned the movement.
I had all the points, but it just took me twice as long to get them as everybody else.
Now, I found it interesting that just a year after you started USPSA, you host Ben Steger.
Yeah. So like, I immediately ran into the same problem with USPSA as I did with IDPA, in that I just had, I like, okay, what do I do now? Like, I know I suck and I don't even know where to start. And one of my buddies, we have local GM, Brad Griffin, who has been around for a while, or Brad Griffin. And he was giving me some tips on moving and like, you got to learn the miss in order to go faster. And it wasn't quite like, it was starting to click a little bit, but not entirely. And then I had seen Ben, his classifier, like his IDPA classifier video. Like there's a video that's like a grainy, like 420p video where Ben just absolutely humiliates the IDPA classifier. And I had never seen anybody shoot like that in person. And then a friend says that he's teaching a class at South River, which is the club I had a membership at. I'm like, this sounds great, but it was full. But I did go and say hi to Ben and introduce myself. And he said, if you want me to come down, just get people for a class and I'll come down and teach it. I'm like, challenge accepted. So I did exactly that. Like I got a band of idiots together and I got their money and then I got Ben and then we had a class and it was extremely different than any class I had before. But in some ways it reminded me a little bit of the outdoor rec stuff. Ben, I think, was very good at taking practical shooting and breaking it down into manageable pieces. And the other shooting that I had done, like the other instructors I had, like weren't, they couldn't break it down that way. And just for being an engineer, that's how I think. I like to break things down into component parts and then work on those and then start assembling them and look for problems as I assemble the parts. And I can still remember a lot of the things from that class and just Ben basically like laughing at me and as I'm trying to do this. But then just like pointing out like, yeah, this is what you need to do. And I just, after that class, I felt like I had a plan on like how I would practice and get better. And then I actually started getting better at matches. And we had a couple other dudes late around here. I mean, Tyler Turner, you've had on your show, and then some other guys.
Yep.
And we were all shooting USPSA production. And we were all pretty much like, yeah, who's going to make GM first? Like we were all like, let's go, let's make this happen. And we talked a lot. We trained together some, we shot matches together. We talked a lot at matches. I mean, we're physically, like geographically, we're distributed a bit. So I wasn't training with Tyler at all, but like he and I would be at every match together and trade notes, and had some other guys who I would train with who are also very enthusiastic, very good. In some cases, we complemented each other. Like I had more of the like disciplined analytical shooting, and the guy I trained with a lot was just a wild man. And like him rubbing off on me was good. Me rubbing off on him was probably good as well. So eventually that didn't take too long. Well, it was a couple of years, but we all got to M class and we all made GM after that.
So I need to interject a question then. Tyler is a hardcore production guy who wanted production to stay at 10 rounds. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on the production 15?
It hasn't changed things as much as anybody would think, I'm finding. I'm neutral. I think I like shooting iron sighted duty guns with like standard magazines. So I'm not that like 10 or 15, like either one's fine. 15 is a little fun in that you're able to blend positions and targets together a little bit more. Like you're not constantly right. getting broken up by reloads, but you're still going to have two or three reloads on a stage. So it still tests that. I kind of think like if you're really like if 10 rounds is what appeals to you, then you should shoot single stack minor.
Until next time.
Don't be a little bitch.
Yeah.